Hello and welcome to Rhymes Against Humanity with Adam Brodsky. We are going to get into the episode soon. We have not a musician, but an author, about musicians. My good friend Tara Murtha came into the studio and talked about the book she wrote. Did I tell you that I have a friend who wrote a book? That makes me pretty darn cool, I'm thinking. Tara Murtha wrote a book called Ode to Billy Joe. Basically, it's part of the 33 and a Third series where writers get into, they pick a famous, an important album, and they get deep into the album, into the groups of the album, and Tara picked "Ode to Billy Joe," the Bobby Gentry record. It was an important record, and you'll hear why in the interview. So she came in. Basically, it was fun for me. I got to pretend that I was Terry Gross, and she pretended that she was Gene Simmons, and we had ourselves a real good time. So I want to tell you that listen to the podcast, and then of course I would advise you to buy the book. You can buy I tell you where to buy the book in the show notes and in the links at her webpage where you can get the book, and we talk about it in the podcast. But also you can get the book personally from her this Friday, December 5th, 2014, at Underground Arts in Philadelphia, because she is throwing a shindig. They're gonna got some great musicians, and they're gonna recreate the entire album tip to tail. So you should show up for that at 8 o'clock, I believe it is, at Underground Arts, and see the that show. Also, I also want to let you know that very Friday, if you another member of the Permanent Records Rhymes Against Humanity family, Jefferson Berry, whose podcast we'll post in a couple of weeks. Jefferson Berry is also having a record release party. Jefferson Berry and the Urban Acoustic Coalition is having his release party at Steel City on that very same Friday. So basically what you need to do is you need to go clone yourself, be in two places at once, cover them both. Jefferson Berry at Steel City in Phoenixville, and then Tara Murtha at Underground Arts. So anyway, hang in here and let's get to the Tara Murtha interview where Adam Brodsky and Tara Murtha talk about Bobby Gentry and whether she slept with Elvis or not. We don't actually talk about that, but afterwards I'll tell you. All right, stay tuned. Rhymes Against Humanity with Adam Brodsky. We are having a very, very, very special. I know sometimes I say very special, sometimes I'm very right, but we're going to get you three varies for Tara Murtha because, holy shit, Tara Murtha wrote a book. That is totally cool. And not only did she write a book, but she wrote a very, very cool book. She wrote a book, a part of the 33 and a Third a series, and she's going to tell us all about that. Ode to Bobby Joe, a whole book about the Bobby...
Billy Joe.
I glance at the cover. So, no, I actually read the book like Jon Stewart does. You know, Larry King doesn't read, and Jon Stewart does. And I looked at the two of those and decided which one I'd rather be. And so at this stage of my life, so I read the book. So anyway, so we're going to have Tara Murtha explain to us. And such. She is going to talk all about... So, ladies and gentlemen... Tara Murtha.
Hello, Adam Brodsky.
Oh, look at that.
It's good to be here.
that's sultry.
This is my radio voice.
It is. It's very good.
For my listeners.
I know, right? So anyway, you wrote a book for the 33 and a Third series. Explain to me what that is.
Okay, so the 33 and a Third is a series of books that have been being published for... I actually just went to the 10th year, the 10-year anniversary party last month. I think that mine's the 102nd in the installment in the series.
Okay.
And so each volume, they're all about the same size or so, 40,000 words or so. And each volume is about one album, one important record.
Yeah.
And so mine is Bobby Gentry, Ode to Billy Joe.
Okay. And the album Bobby Gentry, Ode to Billy Joe. So how did you, you just pitched this and they said, groovy idea.
Yeah, they open up and accept pitches once every 2 to 3 years or so.
Okay.
So I knew that I wanted to do a project on Bobby Gentry and longer than a regular magazine article. I actually wrote my master's thesis as a sort of a book proposal about it, but... By doing that, I realized that I definitely didn't want to do a biography, especially I don't want to do a biography of a perhaps unwilling participant. That's super creepy and weird.
Yeah.
And because I was more interested I am primarily interested in her career,
right.
You know, so biographies have to get into all that other stuff. So I knew mentally I wanted to do that. Ideally, I would do a 33 and a Third. So next time they opened it up, I hacked it up and rewrote it and sent it in, and it was, they chose 15 that year out of, you know, 490 or something like that.
There are a number of women, of strong women, of Jill Sobule is among them. She wrote the foreword for your book,
mm-hmm.
who have been, for various reasons and at various times, captivated by the fascinating story of Bobby Gentry. When did you get turned? Do you have like a moment?
I don't know when exactly it was, but it was in the last 8 years because it was my husband, a gent named Jesse Lendy.
My guitar player.
Familiar with. And so when we first met and we're dating...
And one half of the Philadelphia power couple, the Myrtle Lundy.
The other half, as I like, yeah. So in the stage where he was still interested in impressing me, he was making mixtapes and all that kind of thing.
Oh,
and
that's
he
sweet.
Turned me on to Bobby Gentry. And then what actually interested me the most was the fact that I wasn't so familiar with her, you know,
okay.
being like a Dolly fan and things like that, you know, and just thinking country singer, cool 60s chick country singer is all I knew, you know, in the flesh. And then I looked it up and saw a video and was like, what is going on here?
So why don't you give us the 1 minute Bobby Gentry bio so people that are just like, she just wrote that Ode to Billy Joe song with
right.
Robbie Benson.
Okay. Yeah, so she came, you know, she was a, quote, overnight sensation.
Aren't we all?
Yeah, in 1967, she wrote Ode to Billy Joe, which was, you know, this huge song.
Right.
And then it was subsequently a huge record, and the record knocked Sgt. Pepper's, you know, off the charts.
Mm-hmm.
The album was nominated for 10 Grammys. She won 3. Megastar, first woman the following year to host a variety show on the BBC. And then she's not British. No. In fact, in my research, American executives didn't think that a woman hosting a show would draw any advertisers. So the BBC was ahead there. But anyway, she put out a bunch more records on Capitol and then split the record business in 71, where many people think then that she disappeared at that point. But she actually spent the entire 70s producing these and starring in these really super extravagant Las Vegas productions. I mean, she toured the rest of the world, but her home base was Vegas. And she was like the queen of the Vegas Strip, hosted the Las Vegas Awards. You know, broke records for attendance, broke records for negotiating her own paychecks. She was a really astute businesswoman. So
don't they call that a bitch if you have X chromosome?
Yeah, I heard that's going to expire in like 2058. we're on course for that.
So if that's her story, she must be kicking around today doing lots of great stuff. What's she up to?
Well, that's the thing. So she hasn't been seen. Well, I mean, seen in public sounds so dramatic, but I'm sure someone has seen her in public. But she hasn't appeared in public as Bobby Gentry or performed since the early 80s. I traced. A lot of people mentioned she was on The Tonight Show in 78,
mm-hmm.
And that was her last big performance.
Now, you said that Johnny wasn't there. It was a guest host.
Johnny
do you
wasn't
know
there.
Who the guest host was?
I do, and I put it in the book, and I talked to him and everything, but I can't remember off the top of my head who it was. It was the guy from That's Incredible. John, yeah.
John Davidson.
Yes, that's who it was. Yeah, and he doesn't remember the show. I mean, he doesn't remember
taping. You talked to John Davidson?
I did. Yeah.
That's
I talked
your
to
next
a lot
book.
I talked to a lot of people. I had to be like a professional stalker too. I mean, part of the motivation was that, you know, this record was made in 67, and to write about its production, it's almost 50 years later.
Right.
A lot of people have passed on to the great Blue Yonder since making it. So it's kind of a race against time.
I also imagine you were talking to all of these guys who were seemed like they were older kind of studio execs at the time. Did you talk to a bunch of like 80-year-old Jewish men who can't remember shit?
No, I talked to a bunch of like 80-year-old Jewish men who remembered everything.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, and that was the thing. When you're calling an 80-year-old or, you know, just an older person, be like, oh, I hope it's the like super savvy answer your cell phone in your convertible like going down, you know, and not the
what?
Like...
Who are you?
No, I mean, I talked to a lot of really vibrant people. Yeah, it was really cool. It was really cool.
Okay, so now this album, the album was huge, but the song was so ridiculous. Like this, from reading your book, she wrote this song, and then when various people got a hold of this song, everybody, you know, flipped their lid, like, oh my God, listen to this. This song is going to be amazing. And so this song was the hugest thing.
Yes.
So is it, there's some controversy about who produced it, and even some people are claiming that they helped her write it?
Right. So when I first wanted to write the story, I really, you know, thought it was interesting that the song itself is super mysterious, right? The hook is Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. There's still websites where people debate, why did he jump? There's a line in the song about the girl singing the song being seen throwing something off the bridge. So it has this built-in mystery. It's like, it's the MacGuffin. It's the golden Pulp Fiction suitcase. It's Rosebud, you know. So that has drawn people all this time, pulled people in. So I just thought it was really interesting that there was a parallel between the mystery of the song and then she has not performed in public for so long and refuses interviews and all this stuff. So, you know, I thought that was interesting enough. But once I started doing the research, like the deep research after getting the book contract, I figured out that really sussing out who Bobby Gentry really was a much more interesting question than where is Bobby Gentry.
Possibly my favorite twist of the book is that it turned me around, because I always want to be the smart guy who solves the riddle.
And so
I was like, well, I solved this riddle in 1979 when I first heard this song. I know exactly the story. And then reading your book, I was like, wait, I'm answering the wrong goddamn question.
Yeah, that was exactly. Yeah. I twisted the whole question. In fact, I kind of forgot that I wrote a proposal, and then I wrote the whole book, and of course I slaved over it while while teaching and writing other things, and, you know, with like every waking hour. And then I handed it in, and I was like, oh my God, I had like 80 pages of other things written, but it was because the whole question changed, you know?
Yeah. Okay, so she writes, let's start back in Mississippi. She's born in, where in Mississippi?
She is born in Chickasaw County.
Chickasaw County.
Mm-hmm.
Which is where I would say I was born if I wanted to say I was born in Mississippi.
Chickasaw. You get to say
exactly.
Chickasaw all the time. Yeah.
And then her mom moves her away young, and they moved to California young.
Well, yeah, but you're missing the part. She was raised by her grandparents on a farm, and all the profiles tell you didn't have electricity, you know, raised in poverty in Mississippi until she was about six. And then she moved to the Delta, so a totally distinct area of Mississippi, to live with her father and go to elementary school.
Okay.
And then around 13, she always said 13, she moved to California, where her mother had since moved after her parents broke up.
Okay.
And so I assume her mother sent for her, type of thing.
And months ago, we were talking at the fire the night you made your stage debut, playing some songs. And which, of course, I showed up too late to see the songs. But we had a nice chat anyway.
I was amazing.
You were.
You missed it.
And then you were telling me about how she wrote the song "Fancy" that I, along with every other knucklehead, thinks was a Reba McEntire song.
Right, right.
And the baby's gonna starve to death. That's my favorite line.
I like, and I ain't done bad.
Yeah,
that has like the sash being tossed over the shoulder.
And you say there's an autobiographical piece of that, because her mom, when she was out living in Palm Springs with her mom was sort of, not really turning her out is the wrong word, but maybe, do I remember this right? Her mom was introducing her to fancy men, maybe not in such a sordid way as in the song.
No, I think you're misremembering. I mean, a lot of her...
Maybe that's your own personal...
Her songbook had... Well, I think if I said anything about that, it's more... it seems to be a commentary maybe on her, the role she took on in the music industry, like in the record industry, you know? Because she did, that's kind of, you know, what I get into exploring. She just played a lot of different roles, including the role of Bobby Gentry, who was the little girl from the Mississippi mud, you know. I mean, as one of her guitarists told me, who I didn't get to put in the book, but she was like, you know, all that little girl squishing her toes in the mud, that was a bunch of PR bullshit, you know.
Yeah.
And bullshit sounds aggressive, as if she was some big conspiracy, but it was just one facet of her life that was kind of highlighted to the exclusion of her time growing up in California.
She didn't really want to be a performer at first. She wanted to be a songwriter.
No, right? Yeah, she always, I'm sure to this day, I can't imagine her not still writing, even though she's not performing, thinks of herself as a composer and songwriter.
Now, at the time, those were two different jobs.
Yeah, they were two different jobs.
People were, especially females, tended to stand up there with the big hair at the Ryman.
And I didn't understand that at first, because she was always, I discovered she had been gigging a long time before to Billy Joe, so it makes sense that if you're, so if she's gigging and you're writing and you're composing, but thinking about it in historic context, yeah, it's two totally different things. In fact, she wanted Lou Rawls to record Ode to Billy Joe, and she walked in, once she met up with the producers at Capitol, which her demo was sent over.
Right.
They got a load of her, you know, and they were like, we're going to put you on stage. And she had sang on her own demo only because it was cheaper.
Right.
Yeah. Than hiring a professional. So.
Now there, when they record this demo for Ode to Billy Joe, It's at the end of a session. It's at the end of some other RCA session. They had some extra time.
Yeah, the Checkmates. The Checkmates session. Yeah.
And so they record it in, you know, just a half an hour, a few minutes or whatever. And that pretty much becomes, and this is interesting, and was it, I'm going to get all these names wrong. Is Joe Ford the producer on that?
Kelly Gordon,
okay.
Yeah.
And was he the guy that decided to add the strings?
He's the guy who decided to add the strings, yeah. So Kelly, this is the thing, it was recorded at the end of a Checkmate session, but not the vocal, not the guitar. That was what I found to be really interesting. It was just the strings recorded, so a sweetening session, as they called it on the contracts. Yeah, so it was her, you know, I wind up putting demo in quotes in the book because it was this demo that's been reported on before. You know, her demo got Capitol's attention, but it turns out that the record is essentially her demo with some session work put on top. And in the case of Ode to Billy Joe, she had completely brought that in, completely done except for the strings. Yeah. And according to David Axelrod, who was an executive at Capitol at the time, Larry Shane, who's the publisher that owned it, said, you can have it for $10,000 as long as you don't put any drums on it, you know. And he didn't say anything about strings, so he called up Jimmy Haskell.
Now, in general, as an anti-folky and a punk rocker, I have long thought that strings are what ruined country music, and it has taken, you know, 40 years to get country music back because of everything that strings and French horns have done, and created Ronnie Millsap or whatever. But the strings on this work, amazingly, because somebody said it, and you quoted them in the book, that the song is like a movie.
Yeah,
and so they added strings like a soundtrack to a movie.
Yeah, that was Jimmy Haskell's idea. He told me that he just he's a pearl of a guy, you know, really fun to talk to. He maintains that he didn't do anything special on it, that he did his sort of, you know, his go-to method, which was to introduce strings, to let everyone know, people like you, this is going to have strings. Tune out now, don't bug out. And then he takes them away, and then he brings them swirling back in, and then he does what he calls Mickey Mousing it. Which is if it's a somber note or someone's going down the stairs in the movies, they go like a Mickey Mouse cartoon, right. You know. So that's, he's like, all I did was Mickey Mouse it when they're throwing the flowers off the bridge and
it swirls down. But yeah. That is such a dramatic end of the song,
sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's terrific. So they make they press this and then they press the album and it gets huge. And then how does she end up with these? Is the next step where she ends up touring around the country, right?
Well,
limousine?
So those two things are compressed together. The single came out initially, and that was Mississippi Delta was the flip side, which is what she was trying to sell. She wasn't trying to sell it to Billy Joe, which makes sense because if you've ever heard Mississippi Delta, it sounds like Aretha. It's like a soul, you know, it sounds exactly what was on the radio.
Yeah.
So she... the single came out and it was huge, and then they sent her on a junket with Jess Rand, was her first manager, who was known for working with Sam Cooke and Sammy Davis Jr., and Ken Mansfield, who's known for running Apple for the Beatles, right? So, but he was a young executive and he was sent to kind of be her chaperone, you know, which is why they got caught smoking doobs in the Philadelphia Marriott by nuns and stuff. He has all these fun stories. But
do you know where she played in Philadelphia?
She played, that was a whole... She was scheduled to play with High Lit at High Lit show, and Jess Rand and High Lit got into it because something about cover charge and
pay. Well, they wanted her to play for free.
They wanted her to play for free, yeah, and Jess wasn't having that.
That doesn't seem to be something Bobby Gentry would want to do.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So she wound up, I talked to Jerry Blavitt, of course.
Nice! Always good to chat with the Geeter.
Chatted with the Geeter, and she played on his show, but I'm not sure exactly where else.
Okay.
Where else she played in Philly, yeah.
So, there's a picture in your book, this picture here, can you see it on the radio, that was taken in, it says it was taken in Philadelphia. I swear to God, this is where AKA Music is, right? Like right where the old Celebrity Office was.
Oh, the Beloved Alley?
Yeah.
That's the Beloved Alley.
I mean, I'm just guessing because there's a million alleys and this is just a tiny picture. But this really looks like it to me.
Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know. Unfortunately, Jess Rand just passed away just a couple months ago.
Oh.
But he generously gave me that photo that he took of her, you know, while pre-fame, you know.
Now, this is what I want to talk about. So your investigative journalism took you all over the country to people that had, you know, all these shoeboxes full of this gear.
Mm-hmm.
So, so Jess Rand had all these great photos that he let you use and print. And then tell me about the guy in Oregon.
So this wonderful guy named Brian Holly is really distantly related to Bobby Gentry. Long story short, his father had married Bobby's mother late in life. So he wound up inheriting some boxes of stuff, like cleaning out his dad's stuff when his father passed away, and opened up the boxes. And it was mostly early career memorabilia of Bobby's. And I got in touch with him from stalking him like a reporter, you know, and wound up going out to Oregon and talking with him and looking through this stuff. And it's that connected to Jill Solbuehl, who I was already talking to, because she had connected with him also, because he put a video up on or sent a video to a fan that is a producer of a radio station in Southern Cali. So it's this weird sort of cultish, you know, network of people that I'm now a part of.
Nice.
Yeah.
You're in the creepy club.
Yeah, Jill wrote a song. So that was, Brian didn't really know that Bobby Gentry had, quote, disappeared, you know, that there was a mystery involved. He just thought it was his distant, previously famous relative that he didn't know where she was and, you know, hoped to get all of her things back to her, you know, had followed up on addresses that he had from his dad, you know, earlier and couldn't find her. Then he heard Jill Solbuehl's song on the radio, "Where's Bobby Gentry?"
Right.
And he was like, "What in the Sam hell is Jill Solbuehl talking about?" he emailed her through her website and through the Magic World Wide Web, they wound up connecting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, now this is the part, as I'm reading this book, I'm like, holy shit, because my favorite book, as you may know, because you just met my dog, Queequeg, my favorite book is Moby Dick.
I'm so not surprised.
It's a dude book.
Yeah, I mean...
yeah, don't read it. If you didn't read it in high school. But the thing is, this is your white whale, man.
Like, yeah, yeah.
She's your white whale. How close did you get?
We communicated through an intermediary.
Okay.
Yeah, we did. Of course, I was hoping, you know, that she would break her 30-year trend of turning down interviews to talk with me, but she did not. But she did, I like to think she gave the project her blessing, because she gave me permission to print the lyrics, which I would have been in quite a pickle writing a book about.
She still owns all the publishing?
Yes. So she was able to do that. So for free, you know?
Oh, that is sweet.
I know. So that's why I don't, you know, this is focused on her career, but I still was like, you know, I'm not really sure where her head, I don't know her, you know, where her head's at with this kind of thing. But my sense is that she doesn't mind people writing about her career and, you know, is perfectly fine with that. Doesn't want to be involved, but isn't upset by it. You know, maybe she even enjoys it. I'm not sure. I was advised that she enjoyed reading my communique, but you know, it's showbiz. I'm not really sure, but yeah. So that's how.
Okay. Now, when you started this project, what did you honestly think? I'm gonna get her. She's gonna say yes.
I thought it was possible. I did. I really. I thought it was possible because she'd see what good intentions I have. And, you know. But it's okay. I still think maybe I'll hear from her afterward.
All right.
You know.
Did you send to the intermediary? You sent a copy of the book?
I will be.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Sure.
So now she's she goes to Vegas, and she's in Vegas for a bunch of years, and she's almost her. As I was reading the book, I was like, this parallels Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what was interesting to me. And you talk about how she had always wanted to do more than just her creative arc was going to be more than just songwriting. She was interested, and she hosted the show in the BBC, and she wanted to star in movies and such. Mm-hmm. And
she wanted to produce and direct, not star. Yeah, I think that's the whole getting off stage. The stage was a compromise to begin with.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So she, now for the stage as a compromise, she worked like a dog in those Vegas shows, which are grueling and elaborate.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think she did that? If she was already independently wealthy from the deal she cut with Ode to Billy Joe.
Oh, because I think she loved it. I don't think that she, but like going back to the 67, she, you know, said in interviews that she was willing to perform as long as it didn't get in the way of the writing and composing.
Okay.
It was fun, it was cool, but she had hoped that it would not replace it. But after 10 years in Vegas, I mean, Vegas was changing as 1980 came along, and she was almost 40, you know, and she did these super athletic performances in high heels and like resurrected from the stage and spinning neon bird cages and stuff, you know? So it makes sense that she would finally go into directing and producing like she had wanted to focus on to begin with.
But then?
That's the mystery. There was a lot of projects that she was in the middle of working on, it seemed, and planning on, negotiating for screenplays. Maybe she's accomplishing some of that under a different name.
Ooh, I like that.
That's possible.
Sure.
I mean,
Pulp Fiction. She probably wrote that.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. if suddenly, you know, a memoir comes out. You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't be surprised that if there's this treasure trove of work that she's been doing. I mean, she was a born entertainer. Friends that I talked to said show business was in her blood, you know? So I can't imagine just because you decided to not deal with the bullshit and get out of the spotlight anymore that you suddenly don't have those creative juices flowing, you know, need somewhere to go with them. But she did not do it as Bobby Gentry, that's okay. For sure. Yeah.
Now, essentially, she walked away.
She walked away.
And like, just like, you, what do you say, the trail grows colder, however you phrase it, more eloquently than me just now.
Yeah, well, so early 80s, the big Tonight Show appearance people referenced in 78, couple of networks. She always hosted, like, the, you know, ABC, the network shows.
Right.
Came on, sang a song in 81, 82, gave Willie Nelson Award. She was one of, she hosted the first Country Music Award, so she was tethered to that. And then the trail goes totally cold. The last evidence I found of a planned show is 1983. She had a Vegas show with Mac Davis, and it said that she canceled. She didn't cancel. I mean, this is a woman who performed with like a broken, fractured face, you know?
Yeah.
And that was about it. There's a couple stock photos from 84, 85. Mysteriously enough, I found one from 85, which is the last evidence ever that I found. And she's with David Guetz. I was like, oh my God, I don't know what that's about. But,
Reminds me of remember Eddie and the Cruisers,
right? Yeah. Right, Rimbo. Like, what a strange person to be. You're the last, you know.
Yeah,
yeah.
So she disappears, and my friend Ned, we were discussing this before you showed up. He's downstairs watching football, and he said, "Seems to me like something happened. Like, did you find any evidence that maybe something horrific happened? This girl seems like such a hard worker." So
I did not. No, I talked to most of the people I talked to for the book. I talked to on the record, but I did talk to people off the record who felt conflicted about, you know, not wanting to betray her in any way.
Sure.
But also wanting to feel me out and check my intentions out and make sure that I knew she was cool. And I knew that people emphasize that she really looked out for women coming up in the industry and things like that. She was a badass, you know?
She was negotiating her own contract.
She negotiated her own stuff.
Oh, and tell me about the deal with her short-term manager contracts. I love that story.
Oh, no, the first one. So Jess Rand is this, you know, super, he was a heavyweight, you know. And he went out to connect with her with Ken Mansfield. They were buds from Capitol. And the three of them, Bobby, Ken Mansfield, and Jess Rand, did this East Coast junket. And that was her network debut. And there's parties for her in New York and, you know, the whole thing. She was, you know, the model for this clothing line that was Betsy Johnson's first job, you know, and like all this stuff, you know, that goes into pop culture stuff. So they're at Danny's Hideaway. Jess Rand was a prince of a guy, long time married. Was like, I don't spend my wife's birthday not with my wife, but he could tell me the date he went to this restaurant with her because it was his wife's birthday, right? In 67. And she wouldn't sign a contract with him. They signed on a napkin, but she refused to sign anything longer than 6 months so she could shop her options and make sure that she could tighten it up. And that is not, meanwhile, the headlines and the profiles about her are like, you know, have the word hillbilly in them.
Right.
You know, you know, or like she's, oh, and they're surprised. My favorite one ever is the headline gives her measurements.
Yeah.
Calls them her Miss America measurements, and then whatever the numbers are.
37,
and
they're like, 23, 37. Oh, I read the book last night. So.
Right. And there's like, you know, if she didn't have her Miss America measurements, you might even call her an intellectual. So meanwhile, she's, you know, and it's also a lot of the stories are laughably frame success as this unexpected burden, this big surprise. But she was obviously really, you know, planning for this.
Right.
Yeah. She invested with Henry Mancini in a Phoenix Suns basketball team in 1967.
And Gene Autry also, right?
No, I don't think he was there.
Andy Williams, that's who it was.
Yeah, Andy Williams.
Gene Autry owns the Angels. Yeah. Right, okay.
So, you know, just a very astute investor, set up her own production company and all that stuff within, you know, less than a year than Ode, so.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not your
so classic hillbilly. She doesn't need to go on the, she has no, she has no need to go on the reunion tour for the cash, you know. Yeah, she's just fine.
Okay, so this is the book we've covered. We'll leave a few secrets. I totally recommend y'all get this book. The name of the book is Ode to Billy Joe by Tara Murtha on 33 and a Third. Where can they buy this fine piece of work?
They can buy that. They can go to my website, which is odetobillyjoe333.com, where I'm keeping a running list of indie bookstores. But, of course, it's on Amazon and will be in Barnes & Noble and all those kinds
of stuff. Nice. So a slave could pick this out of a wage slave could pick this out of a bin in 100-degree heat and send it right to you.
If that's your preferred mode, it will go on the record that I have the indie stores.
Yes. Or suppose they wanted to get you to sign something lovely like the inscription. I'm going to read the inscription you signed to me. You said, "For Adam, who is now my friend, love that asshole in Fergie's. XOXO." Apparently, we met a few years before we met, and I did not make a good impression. Nor did you.
We didn't meet exactly, but I observed you from afar, and I wildly disapproved, I will say.
And now not much has changed. Yeah.
Now I observe you closely.
You disapprove from up close.
Right.
So, there should be a record release. Why don't you throw one of those together?
Well, that's the thing. So you can also get a copy. Fresh, hot, warm as a loaf of bread on December 5th, and I will sign it, maybe not calling myself an asshole to people. I'll keep it on the up and up.
There you go.
December 5th is the book release party, and I figured that no one really wants to come and see me read for 20 minutes. So instead, I tapped my friend Phil D'Agostino, a bassist musician in town, and he put together an 8-piece band that's recreating the album from scratch, and it's going to be super awesome.
Awesome. Do you, tell me the band and who's going to play.
So we're calling the band. It's a project coming together for the very first time, the world premiere of the recreation, and we're calling it the Lower 40.
Nice.
Yes. So Phil is the bassist and the band leader. Brad Hinton is
doing
guitar.
My joke. If you take a fancy to anyone in the Lower 40, the chances are pretty good that you could plow them.
I'm not going to endorse that. I'm going. My spirit's in the back of Fergie screaming.
Yeah. Touché, sir.
Right.
All right. So go on. I'm sorry.
So Ross Bellinois.
Yeah.
The famous Philadelphia guitarist / future king of the Bellinois pedal, which is what I keep telling him. Mm-hmm. Brad Hinton, they're handling guitars. Matty Muir on drums. Jay Ansel is handling the strings.
Of course.
Of course.
The harpsist master.
Huge Bobby Gentry fan.
I did not know that. Yes. I know he likes cheese.
Yeah, apparently a huge Bobby Gentry fan.
Okay.
Larry Toft doing horns. Ansel Barnum on harmonica.
Nice.
Who I don't know, but his online biography begins with the line that he sucks on a harmonica and sometimes blows. I'm like, I like this guy.
That's good.
Yeah. And Carl Boehner on vibes.
Okay.
Yes. And then a rotating cast of vocalists.
Yeah, who you got?
So we got Allison Polance. Mm-hmm. Allie Wadsworth.
Yes.
Carrie Hallett.
Unfamiliar.
Carrie Hallett, she's a Philadelphia musician who then moved to Portland. The other one. I was going to say the good one, but then I was like, I actually like the one.
Yeah, they're both, but, yeah.
Yeah, right. That was my hesitation. Anyway, she just moved back, and she did a cover of Nikki Hokie.
Oh, wow.
Because she's a fan about a year ago. And
will she be dressed up in the halter top with the Gentry strut?
Sent it to me. Gentry strut is optional.
Optional.
So she sent it to me about a year ago, and it was super great. So now she's in town. So
that's awesome.
So she's doing the song she sent on Twitter.
Nice.
Which was funny because she's tweeted at me and I didn't know her. And then Boja on Twitter was like, how do you guys know one another?
So, oh, nice.
And Sue Rossetti.
Oh, of course.
Of course. You're familiar with Sue Rossetti.
Yeah.
And Bertie Bush.
That's a great lineup.
Yeah. And then Bertie will be singing Willie to open up.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
That's great. So you going to do the album in order, or how's this going to...
Recreating the album in order.
Oh, that's going to be great.
Yeah. I'm getting texts from Phil that's like, okay, now we're going to do this, because on this song we need... I mean, he's, you know, the guys are building... apparently, they looked for the charts online, and this doesn't exist, so they're building all the charts from scratch. And
holy shit.
And doing it, yeah.
This is great.
Jimmy Haskell teased me when we were on the phone by saying that he's like, oh, I think I have my original charts, you know, in a box in my basement. I'm like, do you need me to come out there and help you go through your basement?
Holy, wow.
I'll go out there, you know, so maybe one day we'll get a look at that too. But so it didn't exist in there. They're putting it all together.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So what do you say that we just, do you have any idea where she's living now?
I do. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Because I know you. Because at the end of the book, you mentioned that she moves around and she's in different places.
Anything that I found out that was private and didn't inform the question of who was Bobby Gentry in the context of being this like pioneering feminist badass composer musician in the 60s, I left out.
That's respectful as hell.
Totally.
Yeah, sisters got to stick together and all that.
Of course. And I will say that finding Bobby Gentry was easier than finding talking to a PR person at Capitol. I never wound up getting through to Capitol Records.
Nothing's changed. They don't got time. They're so busy making all the money at the record companies.
Yeah.
They're making it hand over fist these
days. Right, the Victory Lab over there.
So tell us again when and where the show is.
The show is December 5th, Friday evening at Underground Arts. And
yes.
The doors open at 8.
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock.
And come and get your copy of Ode to Billy Joe by Tara Murtha, part of the 33 and a Third series. My name has been Adam Brodsky, and we will probably at this point I'm changing it. For political purposes. And we will probably let Bobby Gentry take us out.
All right, right
with something. So thank you so much for coming by. This was
Thanks for having me.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. And you guys, this has been Rhymes Against Humanity, and this will be Bobby Gentry. And we are clear.
It was a 3rd of June, another sleepy, dusty Delta day. I was out chopping cotton and my brother was baling hay. And at dinner time we stopped and walked back to the house to eat. And Mama hollered at the back door, y'all remember to wipe your feet. And then she said, I got some news this morning from Choctaw Ridge. Today Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. And Papa said to Mama as he passed around the black-eyed peas, oh, Billy Joe never had liquor since. Pass the biscuits, please. There's 5 more acres in the lower 40 I got to plant. And Mama said it was a shame about Billy Joe. Seems like nothing ever comes to no good up on Choctaw Ridge. Said he recollected when he and Tom and Billy Joe put a frog down my back at the Carroll County Picture Show. And wasn't I talking to him after church last Sunday night? I'll have another piece of apple pie. You know, it don't seem right. I saw him at the sawmill yesterday up on Choctaw Ridge. And now you tell me Billy Joe's jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Mama said to me, child, what's happened to your appetite? Well, I've been cooking all morning and you haven't touched a single bite. That nice young preacher, Brother Taylor, dropped by today. Said he'd be pleased to have dinner on Sunday. Oh, by the way, he said he saw a girl that looked a lot like you up on Choctaw Ridge. And she and Billy Joe was throwing something on the Tallahatchie Bridge. A year is come and gone since we heard the news about Billy Joe. And mother, Mary Becky Thompson, they bought a store in Tupelo. There was a virus going round, Papa caught it and he died last spring. And now Mama doesn't seem to want to do much of anything. And me, I spend a lot of time picking flowers up on Choctaw.